Softening institution, hardening growth model, question mark. The question mark, as far as I'm concerned, is cosmetic, because I have no doubt that institutions are softening and the growth model is hardening. The transformation of the German political economy. Maybe just a small, how much time do we have?
About 45 minutes.
Just a small preface. This is personal stuff. Kiara is not concerned. So you may wonder, what is this guy who barely speaks German, has a rudimentary knowledge of, somebody then will fix this, okay? Knowledge of German, writing a paper on a German political economy. And the reason is that I became convinced after the beginning of the crisis that studying the German political economy was crucial to understand capitalism and to understand the other countries in Europe. So that's why I made this investment, and Kiara is not concerned because the German political economy is at the core of her interests. We're going to make an argument in 3 points. The first is that the German political economy is shifting. There's a fundamental transformation from a wage-led to a profit-led growth model, specifically export-led, and then I will explain what it is. This shift is partly explained by the softening of industrial relations institution, partly because, of course, it takes more than simply the repression of internal consumption and the weakening of the distributional function of industrial relations. You also need a supply side apparatus that can actually sell the stuff. So it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, notwithstanding it's an important condition. The weakening of industrial relations institutions has facilitated wage repression and held back domestic consumption, making the German model a model of unbalanced growth. Growth is still possible, but it is unbalanced, and possibly it's a self-contradictory model of growth. And the third point is that this shift helps us understand the position taken by the German elites in the euro crisis. And this is, by the way, the reason why I became interested in these issues in the first place. So I'm going to cover 1 and 3, and then Chiara will cover 2. So to understand wage-led and profit-led growth, one has to go back to something that I think has been forgotten, namely that there is a tradition in macroeconomics that goes back to Keynes, to Keynes, and especially Kolesky, that is very different from the traditional Nairo-based macroeconomics, and it emphasizes not just the importance of aggregate demand, but the importance of distribution, particularly the functional distribution of income. Just a few. What is Nairo-based macroeconomics? Essentially, it's the idea that labor market outcomes are determined by the supply side, and that demand doesn't matter. And it's not very different from the Marxian idea of a reserve army. It's essentially the idea that you need the unemployed to discipline organized labor. It's as simple as that. And so if you want to improve labor market outcomes, you have to reduce the organized power of labor and reduce institutional protections for labor. And this, simple as it is, has been the hard core of policy recommendations for the last 30 years. There is a different approach to macroeconomics that I'm going to go in briefly today, which goes back to Kolesky in particular. Essentially, the idea is this is the accounting identity. Y income is the sum of consumption C plus I investments plus G, which is the public budget, plus X, net exports. Growth is going to come from one of these elements. We consider G to be exogenous here, and I think it's a fair assumption given the institutional constraints on the public budgets. Growth is going to come either from C, from I, or from X. And then to figure out whether the model is profit-led or wage-led, you have to calculate. When you have a marginal increase, a 1% increase in the profit share, what is the overall impact on growth? And if that derivative is greater than zero, then you have a profit-led model. If it is less than zero, you have a wage-led model. Now, the causal mechanisms are difficult. So if you increase the profit share, namely you decrease the wage share, you're going to stimulate investments and net exports. Investments because they depend on profitability, as well as interest rates and as well as perspectives of growth. And X, net exports, because exports depend on the comparison between export price and world prices. On the other hand, if you increase the profit share, namely you decrease the wage share, consumption is gonna suffer. And it's gonna suffer because wage income and profit income have different propensity to consume. And if you increase profit income, you're gonna reduce consumption. So you have, by increasing the profit share, you have two different mechanisms. On the one hand, you're gonna depress consumption. On the other hand, you may stimulate investments and profits. And whether an economy is profit-led or wage-led will depend on to how these partial effects sum up. So will the increase in I and X exceed the decrease in C? And this depends not just on the elasticities. The elasticities are transformed into marginal effects by multiplying them by the share of investments and exports in GDP. Most advanced economies are wage-led, especially the large ones. The argument we're going to make here is that Germany is turning into a profit-led economy. Specifically, because investments have been declining as a share of GDP, it is turning into an export-led economy. Namely, this distributional maneuver, increasing the profit share at the expense of the wage share, is generating growth because the growth in exports is greater than the recessionary effect of the decrease of the wage share on consumption. That's the argument about the growth model. So let me drive you some aggregate statistics. So this is the German wage share. It's increasing up to 1980, and then 30 years of decline. This is consumption, and this is something I was really surprised by. Consumption as a percentage of GDP is constantly increasing in West Germany. Then comes unification. It's a real shock. You have a step increase. This is what really worried the Bundesbank. A step increase in consumption that led to the, you know, the policy of high interest rates, and then constant decline. So it looks as though, by looking at this graph, something changed in Germany in 1990. So maybe with your help, we'll figure it out. But in speaking with the language of the statisticians, there's a structural break. These are exports, and here too, there's a structural break. West Germany was, I mean, exports have always been very important in Germany, but, you know, they were growing gently, just like everywhere else. And then unification comes, there's a step decrease, and then a much steeper curve. Exports in 2010 were more than 50% of GDP. This is the percentage that you traditionally find in small economies, you know, the Katzensteinian small markets, as on small countries, etc. And so the trends are, the wage share has been declining for 30 years, there's been a decline in household consumption from 1990 on, and a steep increase in exports as percentage of GDP from 1990 on. Okay, this is now the calculation of whether this is a profit-led or a wage-led model. This is the marginal effect on GDP growth of a 1% increase in the profit share. I think possibly for the next iteration of this paper, I will redo the estimates myself. For the time being, I've just used the estimates, recent estimates, by two economists, Onaran and Galanis, that go from 1961 to 2007. So I've used their elasticities. You'll find the elasticities in the paper. I have multiplied them by the changing shares, and this is what it gives. It gives a lot of suffering, and we will see this is in common. So restrictive macroeconomic policies have recessionary consequences in Germany up to 1990 because the negative effect on consumption prevails, and then things turn around. And at this point in time, Germany is about at the point of indifference between wage-led and profit-led. Essentially, this means that capital has truly become the general class. This is like the paradise of economists. Like, through trickle-down effects, by boosting profits, everyone benefits. Now, this is France, and it's a very different story. So, restrictive macroeconomic policies, the French expression, en français, they throw down the French economy more and more. And this is Italy, same story, possibly some turning around. Possibly, hopefully, some turning around. Anyway, Germany is a very different beast, okay, from other large Euro area countries. And so, policies that could be appropriate for Germany at this point in time are pernicious. This is our argument for the rest of the Eurozone. How this is now how the different effect between domestic demand and external demand. So the same thing, how 1% increase in the profit share affects domestic demand is consumption and investments. And how the same thing affects external demand. And you can see that Germany remains very much affected by the repression of wages and consumptions, but over time, exports more than counterbalance. In synthesis, and this is the end of the first part, the German political economy has been repressing household consumption. It's not quite a profit-led economy yet. Argentina is a profit-led economy, okay? But it is at this point, if you believe our estimates, at a point of indifference, the wage share has decreased dramatically, which implies that profits have grown. And now the next step is what explains the shift. And our argument is that contrary to, say, neoclassical models of growth, the Solow-Swan models of growth, it just assumes that the wages are going to grow at the same pace as productivity increases. Our argument is that in the real world, you need actors and institutions to make sure that that transition happens. And those actors and institutions that balance the German growth model are no longer there. Or they have become so weak that they are no longer able to counterbalance this shift towards profit-led growth.
Right, so I'm going first to sort of illustrate how Germany was in the 70s, 80s, then to explain the trajectories of liberalization which I was talking about, and then present like a picture of Germany now, basically, and how German industrial relations look like. So, the Modell Deutschland, this is how it is. It has been called in the literature, and especially I would like to focus on the product strategy of the model of production in Germany, which was the diversified quality production model. This was characterized by the same size, production size of mass production, but also like a broader range of products which could serve also high market segments, because the products were high quality and required also complex and innovative technology, and this required the specific skilled workforce, which the fundamental institutions provided to the model, which is the vocational training. So vocational training provided the specific skilled workers which could deal with like technological innovation, complex technology, and at the same time, which required a sort of organizational work, which is different from the typical Fordist organization of the mass production. And this is where the second enabling constraint of the diversified quality production model comes into play, which are the institutions of industrial relations. That in terms of like work organizations, work council were like the most important institutions. They cooperated with the management and they made sure and pushed and forced management to use at its best the specific skills of the workforce through a non-tailoristic work organization. Sectoral bargaining institutions were also fundamental because they set homogeneous wage standards across the companies. And this was on one side a limitation for the employers because they could not compete over wage cost. But on the other side, it was also an incentive to invest in technology in order to raise the productivity. And also it limited the risk of poaching of the specific skilled workers I was talking about, like between the companies. So the literature in those years, like illustrating and explaining the German model is really focused, it's really focused on the supply side of the model, so on the factors which contributed to the success of the diversified quality production model. We want to think about the demand side, so how the institutions, especially the institution of industrial relations, also served the demand side of the DQP model. And this is because institutions have a redistributive function, as Lucia was saying earlier, and we can think about sectoral bargaining institutions as institutions redistributing our income between high productive labor in high productive companies to low productive labor in low productive companies. To pattern bargaining is the system of wage coordination in Germany. So basically the agreement between Gesamtmetall and IG Metall, it orientates towards the overall productivity rate. And then in order to set wage floor, a negotiating floor for all the other unions in the other sectors. So it's sort of taking this as a reference point from all the other unions. So this system of pattern bargaining, this redistributes the income between high value added sectors, such as the core manufacturing sectors and the service sectors. And the worst concept, of course, they redistributed the income within the company. So they enforced the sectoral collective agreement and they made sure that all the workers were covered by the same agreement. Both the workers in high value added segments, such as like assembly line, machine tool, but also the workers in the logistics and the catering. So they were all along the value chain, all under the same collective agreement. So what happened to this redistributive mechanism? So I'm going to focus here, like on this slide, on the decentralization of bargaining. And the first step was the working time reduction offensive. So there was, at the beginning of the 80s, there was high unemployment rate, the economic growth had slowed down, and unions had changed their bargaining policy and orientated it towards more qualitative aspects, in particular work-life balance or working time. In 1983, IG Metall asked for a reduction of working time to 35 hours per week. And this was on one side in line with this qualitative orientation, but it was also like an attempt to reduce unemployment, to respond to growing unemployment rates. So after strikes, 7-week strikes, the employers, the Gesamtmetall and IG Metall arrived to an agreement, achieved an agreement, but this was on the reduction of working time. But this was only possible through clauses at workplace level. So this was the first step towards decentralization because these opening clauses actually spread very quickly and the working time reduction wasn't really achieved only like in the West metal industry and the printing industry and actually many years later. So another step forward to the decentralization was in occasion of the failure of the Stufenplan in Eastern Germany. After the unification, there was the goal to achieve wage parity between Eastern and Western Germany, and employers had agreed on it. But then the crisis, the unemployment rates started exploding, and basically the Eastern German economy collapsed, and there was increasing discontent among Eastern employers who weren't ready anymore to bear the cost of high wages. So Gesamtmetall had to answer, to give a response to this loss of legitimacy, because Eastern employers did not want to join the employers' association anymore and refused to apply the collective agreement and wanted more flexibility. So Gesamtmetall asked for opening clauses, which IG Metall initially refused, but then they found an agreement in exchange of maintaining the goal of wage parity, but just delaying a few years later. And this agreement on hardship clauses was based on the idea that companies which were having a hard time, so to say, could apply for amending the collective agreements, for example, extending the working time, cutting wages, but under the control of the social partners. IG Metall was actually against it also because it feared that they could spread also in Western Germany. And this is exactly what happened during the crisis at the beginning of the 90s, when unemployment rate was exploding in Germany and the diversified quality production model wasn't successful anymore. And companies responded to it by segmenting their value chain into modules, transferring some parts of the production abroad or to suppliers. So under these conditions, the pacts for employment and competitiveness were bargained at company level. And they spread also very quickly across Germany, and they were mainly based on working time and wage cuts and wage freezes. So they were the main contents, and they were not so under control as they were the hardship clauses. At the same time, another response to the growing unemployment rate came at the national level from the Alliance for Jobs. And the first one was launched by the head of IG Metall in 1995. And the idea was that employers and unions and government would negotiate over investments in training, social benefits, and also on wage moderation. At the end, so it was much more focused on wage moderation, and unions stepped out of it. And a package of cuts was passed by the parliament without union agreement. Second Alliance was still like very focused on wage moderation, and labor was really divided. On one side, the chemical union, IG Betze, wanted to negotiate, and IG Metall didn't. And when labor is divided, they tend to lose. So at the end, they bargained wage moderation, and that was the main achievement of the Second Alliance. And labor was actually still divided when the time of the Hartz reform came. Still on one side, the oppositional IG Metall and Verdi, the service union, and on the other side, the chemical unions and other unions, which actually were ready to bargain over the Hartz reforms, while the others completely refused them. The attempts of the DGB to coordinate a union's policy failed, and unions bargained, but with very poor income, with very poor also income, but also with very poor outcomes. The deregulation of agency work, and also when they bargained the collective agreements, they didn't manage to set the principle of equal pay, so agency workers are paid less so far, and the deregulation of mini jobs through Hartz II. And then, of course, I don't have to explain you Hartz fears, the change of the unemployment security system, and a change also of the criteria of acceptability of jobs. And these reforms sort of filled in this reserve army, probably Lucio was talking about, and increased the competitions between low-wage and high-wage employees and unemployed and employed. So after all these trends, all what happened, so what is the main interpretation of the German model now? What is the main interpretation of the German? Yes, here. So according to the dualization literature, there is a core of manufacturing export sector, which is still coordinated. So where labor and management still like cooperate, and it sort of reflects the traditional industrial relations institutions. And there is a segment of flexible, deregulated service periphery. And these two segments are actually in a stable dual equilibrium. So because this equilibrium is supported by a cross-class coalition, a producers' coalition between unions, works councils, and management in the core coordinated sectors. They have the common interest of keeping the labor costs low in order to be competitive on international markets. And for doing this, they agree to compress the labor costs in the service periphery, and they maintain the good working condition in the core. So we look, on the basis of this interpretation, we look at what happened in Germany now, and especially in the manufacturing companies. Okay, we know that overall union density has been declining. It's 18% now, and one third are still in the AG Metall. But even more importantly, it's the employer's density is declining, and it's 18% in Eastern Germany in the metal sector, and 57% in Western Germany. So this is really important for the coverage of collective bargaining, which has been declining as well. It has been declining, yes. And I can show you from this table here, which it comes from the data we are using from the IAB, so we are still checking them. They regard only manufacturing companies in machine tool, electronics, chemical sector, automotive. And these are the number of the percentage of companies which are covered on the left side by the sectoral agreement, and here by the company level agreement. And we can see that there is an incredible decline. From 1995, it was almost 60%, now it's 22.7. And this is not actually compensated by the company level agreement, which didn't decline but remained pretty much the same. Other dimensions of erosion of collective bargaining also in core companies, in core manufacturing sector, is the increase of agency work. They are not covered by the same agreement. And also the increase of subcontracting, which actually, in particular, the proliferation of industrial services. So all these services which used to belong to the metal sector, such as components, logistics, and they used to be covered by the sectoral metal agreement, and they are not anymore. Another interesting table is the one on opening clauses. This regards only manufacturing companies with a sectoral agreement. We can see that more than 70%, 75% of companies had opening clauses, most of them on working time, but also 35, 36, 38% also on wage cuts. And this is interesting also because the data we are still checking, we are still not very confident, but the analysis we run only on export-oriented companies show exactly the same results, meaning that there is not so much difference between like all the companies and these core coordinated companies. The last redistributing mechanism which has not been working very well recently is the pattern bargaining. This is actually a figure made by the DC in Düsseldorf, and we can see the gray green dot, big dot line. Oh no. This one, the upper line here, it's like so cool. Yeah, this line here is the price and productivity rate together. And we can see only that the chemical and the metal sector can actually keep up with this development. And we see here like an increasing divide with the service sector, especially the retail sector, which is at the same pace of the inflation. So there is an increasing gap between the two sectors, which is actually quite consistent with what the dualization literature was saying. So the question is whether this is a stable cross-class coalition, a stable equilibrium. We could see signs that something is changing, that we wonder whether this is like politically sustainable for IG Metall. IG Metall has increasingly turned towards agency workers and workers in subcontracting. This could also be interpreted as an attempt to control works councils. Maybe this decentralized bargaining was not so much under control as it is interpreted to be. And also what is interesting is the new bargaining orientation in the last bargaining round of IG Metall and the statements about regaining the purchasing power. And this is interesting because it was one of the main on the main point of the disputes between Verdi, the service sector union, and IG Metall, because Verdi accused basically IG Metall not to care about pushing actually the internal demand, which is what a service sector union is relies on. So that was my part. Now I hand over to Lucia again.
Thank you very much. So just to remind you of the figures that she has presented, more than 3 out of 4 manufacturing companies don't have a collective agreement. And of those, that one that has it, 75% has an opening clause. I think we can coin the Colander sectoral system of sectoral bargaining or something like that. No, colander. The colander is the thing that you use to cook the spaghetti. It has lots of holes. So the third part and the concluding part is Germany in the Euro crisis. Because I think what we told you explains why the German position is so different from the position of pretty much everyone else, with the exception of the Netherlands. Let's say pretty much everyone else in the south of Europe, where south includes France as well. What's the nature of the euro crisis? The euro crisis is not a crisis of profligacy. I'm not going to belabor this point, but with the exception of Greece, it just doesn't apply. This is a crisis of confidence. It's a crisis because there's no lender of land resort for these peripheral countries. And when there's no lender of land last resort, the countries are at the mercy of financial markets. And then there are multiple equilibria. Essentially, the countries are going to be solvent if the financial markets believe that they are solvent. If they believe that they're solvent, they're solvent. If they don't believe that they're solvent, they're not solvent. So the expectation fulfill themselves. And the belief of the international markets depends on their belief on what the European Central Bank and the European policymaking authorities are going to do. So the European Central Bank has the power, the magical power, to say at some point, we will do whatever it takes. And that works. And it did work. It did work for a while. However, Germany, as you know, has been ferociously opposed to European Central Bank interventionism, staunchly supported austerity and structural reform. Structural reforms means deregulation, that's what it means, of the labor market. In the peripheral countries, even when the evidence was mounting, and even the IMF, let alone Mark Blythe, okay? The IMF was writing papers saying, we made a mistake, the size of the fiscal multipliers is much higher than we thought it was, which is IMF speak for these things are not working, you should change. So why? Why is that the case? And I think you know the answer. And the answer is that this is a very different economy from everyone else. Austerity policy is disastrous for France and Italy and let alone Greece. Okay, nobody cares about Greece. But not necessarily for Germany, to the extent that world demand continues to be buoyant. And that's a big, big if. So 2 years ago, I think, I was discussing these issues with Wolfgang. And half, I was sort of complaining, why do the German policymaking elites do what they do? And he, I think it was a joke, I hope, he said, well, Germany doesn't need you guys anymore. We're going to sell to China. We're selling to China. Because I, you know, what I I take what Wolfgang said very seriously. I want to check. Can they sell to China? And that, yes, so there is, this is the destination of exports. German exports, remember, German exports are 52% of GDP. Very important, the most important element of aggregate demand. So there is a substitution process going on. China is growing. BRICS are growing. But Eurozone 12, 11 actually, because Germany is out, is still 40% of German exports. So the substitution process is taking a long time. And so austerity policies are bound to catch up with Germany. And they are catching up with Germany. Which brings us to a quote that I'd like to read you from Baduri and Marklin, which I think summarizes the problem for advanced capitalism at this point. A dominant trade effect tends to make the stagnationist, this is wage-led, logic increasingly irrelevant in a world characterized by high trade interdependence. The left social democratic emphasis on wage-led expansion derived from the stagnationist, again, wage-led logic, may be given up in the pursuit of export surplus by following restrictive macroeconomic policies to keep down real wages and inflation for greater international price competitiveness. Further, so long as successful export performance maintains a high enough level of employment to overcompensate a relatively low real wage rate, cooperation between labor and capital may continue to be feasible. The only problem with this strategy is that it is impossible for all countries to achieve a trade surplus simultaneously. And yet, the lure of this impossibility has contributed substantially to the disintegration of the traditional social democratic ideology without any coherent alternative taking its place. So, concluding remarks, let me remind you of the argument. 3 points. The German political economy is shifting fundamentally from wage-led to profit-led. This shift is at least partly explained by the colander thing that I talked about, this extreme weakening of institutions that took care of something that economics just assumed, the transfer of productivity gains to the internal demand side, and that the shift to profit-led growth contributes to explaining why Germany takes this position that it takes in the euro crisis. Let me finish with some methodological consideration. So I guess this paper is an invitation to consider whether we should update the tool belt of comparative political economy. And as Chiara was saying, the theories that we have in comparative political economy are essentially supply-side theories. Theories that emphasize why institutions made for manufacturing or economic success, but that they are entirely on the supply side. And I think in the paper we remind the reader that the article on diversified policy quality production appeared in a book entitled Beyond Keynesianism. I think that the title is telling. We think that aggregate demand needs to be brought in and distribution needs to be brought in. Now, the question is talking about wage-led versus profit-led better than CME versus LME? Clearly not. I mean, it can be as schematic, as functionalist as the other one, but it has one advantage, in my opinion. First of all, it disposes of this notion of equilibrium, that there are social equilibrium. And it doesn't force you to throw under the rug the mounting evidence that the key actors are not necessarily buying into fully the supposed equilibrium. Also, this approach that reincorporates distribution, redistribution, and heterodox macroeconomics. Of course, it needs to be integrated with an historical analysis of the processes, of the mechanisms, because otherwise these are just regression results. They don't mean anything. But the advantage is that because these are not equilibria, you see immediately why they may change And they, you see immediately why there may be a tendency for them to change in a particular, in a distributionally orientated direction. Because with globalization, two things happen. Investments become more sensitive to the international rate of return to capital. And second, exports become much more important for all these economies. So globalization seems to have an inbuilt bias toward against wage labor. And I will leave you with that.